Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Zoe McLaren. She is an associate professor in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Zoe, thanks for joining me today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Nick.
So I'm especially excited to interview you. You have such an incredible background that is so relevant to the current crisis with deep insights. But for the benefit of the listeners, could you share a little bit of, what got you to this point as a professor in Maryland?
Sure. My PhD is in economics and public policy. And so that training was really about statistical analysis and then thinking about kind of government priorities and the policy process and politics as well. And so I focused on major challenges, primarily in low-income countries, around health policy and economic policy. So that's kind of my training background. And then I spent 8 years on faculty at the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan. And so there I got kind of even more exposure, training, work within public health. And so my area of expertise really spans economics, statistics, policy, public health. And then I also bring to kind of my research in my professional world a deep empathy for people that are suffering through kind of economic crises and public health crises, as well as an interest in kind of current events and news. And so trying to get a sense of kind of what's actually going on in real life so that my policy expertise is informed not just from what I've read in a book or done research on, but also kind of what's going on from day to day.
So practical policy. And I think, you know, prior to COVID-19, you were focused on, you know, some of the diseases that are impacting our populations, HIV and TB. So in many respects, COVID-19 wasn't new from an approach standpoint. Is that true?
So that's part of why I became involved in research on COVID-19 is because my background had been working on HIV and tuberculosis, primarily in Africa, but a lot of the same lessons apply in terms of thinking about these are both infectious diseases, population-wide, and then also the idea about kind of low-resource environments. So we don't have all the resources we need to fight COVID-19. We didn't when it arrived. And so thinking about how to make do in those types of environments is something that I have a lot of experience with. So thinking about that maybe you can't do first best. You need to figure out what second best is, that you have to make do. You have to leverage all of the resources you have and use them efficiently. So I think kind of my perspective and my experience working with those two epidemics really helped kind of inform my approach to COVID-19. Tuberculosis is transmitted via the air in much the same way as COVID-19 is. And then also the HIV epidemic has important lessons as well.
Right. And, you know, the best available option is always available. Perfect almost never is. And finding what's appropriate within the resources. So let's get right to it. I mean, we have, you know, this pandemic sweeping across the constantly moving state of understanding and knowledge. And one of the areas that you've really sort of commented a lot on, have deep insights, is around testing. And it's really complicated from the general perspective because, first of all, we've got lots of different tests. And then, should I be getting a test? Tell us, as simply as you can, your thoughts around testing and how we approach this from the COVID-19 pandemic standpoint.
And so I come to this thinking about decision making. So the policy decisions that are made by both the government and also the population constituents determining what they want to lobby the government for, it is all about decision making. And there's a lot of uncertainty involved. And so what I do is think about how we can leverage the data that we have to produce evidence. So the data doesn't always tell us exactly what's going on. We need to think about how to process that data in a way that tells us what's actually going on. And then once we know what's going on, how to translate that into useful guidance for actual policy. So thinking what the government can do and also what individuals can do. So that that's what I think about a lot. And testing is a very, very important source of information. And you've heard the phrase, knowledge is power. That is, testing is incredibly powerful because it produces knowledge. And that knowledge can be used by a number of different people. So the person who gets the test gets knowledge that helps them guide their own behavior and communicate with those around them. When a test is positive, that information is generally reported back to public health authorities that can make decisions about contact tracing, about allocation of resources, about the need for potential hospital beds in the future. And then that information is also available for kind of more surveillance processes where we want to let the public know about the dynamics of the epidemic. So everybody has looked at the case counts, the hospitalization counts, the mortality counts. That information comes from our testing programs. And that information is what people use all the time to determine whether they should cancel Thanksgiving with their family, whether they should travel for Christmas, how safe they feel going out and interacting with other people, how important it is to wear a mask. And so testing provides information for all of these components. So one single test feeds into all of those pathways. And that's one reason why testing is so important.
So when you think about testing and the current levels that we have, we hear sort of different versions of positivity. Can you explain a little bit behind the various positivity rates? So there's, you know, the general population, there's a percentage. What do those numbers mean and how do we interpret them both on a policy level, but also as an individual level? If I hear that the positivity rate is X in my community, what do those things mean to you and how should we interpret?
So the idea with all the data that we have, and so I think it's important to think about, well, when we want to understand what the data mean, we need to think about how that data are collected. And so right now, our data about COVID-19 comes through testing. And we're not doing very many kind of population surveys. Not everybody's getting a test. People are individually deciding that they want a test or need a test and are going and seeking out a test. And that's how people end up in the data that we see, or they're realizing they need to go to the hospital. And then they're ending up in our data. So if we look at our case data, it really is about what proportion of the people who decide they need a test or who are or advise they should get a test are actually testing positive. And that gives us some information about the overall prevalence in the population, but it's a biased estimate of the overall prevalence. So when we see a test positivity rate of 12%, it doesn't mean that 12% of the population is infected with COVID-19. It means it's actually much less than that, but we don't know exactly how much less. And so part of it is saying, well, when we have this data that's imperfect, it's a biased estimate, is it totally useless? Or is there still some information in this biased estimate that we can still use? And so, for example, with test positivity, we know that even though we can't back out directly from a particular number of test positivity, what the actual prevalence is, that we know that when test positivity is high, it's going to suggest two things. One, that there are a lot of cases in the population. And two, that there are a lot of cases in the population that aren't getting a test and haven't been tested and may not know and may be spreading kind of COVID-19 unawares. And so that's one kind of that we know a lot of cases and a lot of cases spreading.
So you obviously look internationally, you know, we're doing... you know, we have our own process here. We're not doing surveillance testing in this country. Are there other countries that you can point to where they've actually managed to implement that kind of policy that has helped inform some of the decision making and to success?
So I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding about what the word surveillance testing means. Mm-hmm. I think you're thinking about doing these kind of random population samples to kind of get an idea of prevalence, but actually any testing data is technically some sort of surveillance data. And we have different types of surveillance data we use. So sometimes you might use like an early warning surveillance data, where if there's very low prevalence of something, that if there's ever a single case that needs to be reported, and then we get kind of a warning that there's cases in a particular area, we may do these population-wide surveys. That's a way of doing surveillance, but actually just the routine data that's collected through testing, we also consider surveillance data, but it's the type of for surveillance data that we need to analyze more carefully in order to determine what it tells us. Even though we can potentially follow trends of test positivity. So for example, when test positivity is rising, that's generally a concern. When test positivity is rising and then all of a sudden it starts to fall, well, that's important information. We need to think about, well, what changed? Why is it all of a sudden kind of turning around and starting to fall? Is it something about changes in testing? Is it about changes in prevalence? Is it about changes in the demand for testing or who's just determining that they need a test? And so it does give us important surveillance information, but not this population-wide random sample or even universal testing where everyone is tested. So there's a number of different ways we can do surveillance. And that's kind of my academic area of expertise, is saying, when we don't have the type of surveillance data that we want that makes this stuff easy, what can we do with the kind of biased and imperfect surveillance data that we actually have? And so I've done work on tuberculosis in South Africa saying, well, we just have the same thing, just people who decided they needed a TB test, got a TB test, they're in. We don't have a random population survey. We aren't doing any kind of particular sentinel testing. And so how do we take that information and learn about prevalence and changes in prevalence from that?
So all bets off, no restrictions, resources, capabilities, compliance. In a perfect world, what would perfect surveillance testing be for a population? Is that 100% of the time every day?
So for surveillance, the purpose is to use surveillance testing to figure out, kind of to learn what's actually going on with the dynamics of the epidemic. So that's kind of one purpose of testing. But that surveillance testing is actually not what I think right now, but what the goal is for testing. It's not actually, my number one goal is actually not surveillance. My number one goal is making testing widely accessible to everybody. Because knowing where the epidemic is does not save lives as well as making sure that every individual knows whether they're contagious or not and is able to change their behavior or get support to be able to slow the transmission. So the ultimate purpose of testing in an epidemic is to slow transmission, is to save lives, is to prevent people from being hospitalized. And so we can use surveillance data to do that. But in some ways, surveillance data is an indirect route to saving lives and basically getting information to people who need it to prevent the spread and prevent cases is actually one of the best ways that we can employ testing.
So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist. And today I'm talking to Dr. Zoe McLaren. She is an associate professor in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. We were just talking about testing, surveillance, and the various forms of surveillance. And I think if I heard you correctly, it doesn't matter where this data is coming from, even with the bias that comes with it through that pre-selection process, there are still means of extracting useful information that can inform public policy and even clearly individual decision-making. So as you think about the current testing program and, you know, obviously the desire to increase that as much as possible. First of all, how do we increase it? And then how do we measure success of the testing program? Not in terms, I mean, success is, you know, disappearance of COVID-19, I think, but, you know, steps back from that. What does success look like for you?
So maybe I'll start by answering the question about success and then mm-hmm. move on. Ultimate goal of testing is to end the pandemic. It's to eliminate deaths. It's to prevent hospitalizations. It's to prevent people getting seriously ill, even if they're not hospitalized. It's preventing infection. And it's also allowing us to reopen the economy and engage in all of our usual activities without the fear of contracting COVID-19. So that is really the ultimate goal of testing. And we think, well, what does testing need to do in order for us to get there? So testing needs to provide information that we can then use for public health programs and for changing individual behavior, and also for general policy. Economic policy should be informed by test results for COVID-19 as well. And so we need to have that information to be able to make good decisions that are then going to lead to all of these positive outcomes that we're aiming for. And in an ideal situation, everybody would know at all times whether they were contagious with COVID-19. Because if they knew they were contagious, then they would be able to individually take precautions to avoid spreading it. It also would be helpful if people other than the person themselves knew about infections in certain cases. For example, by saying you're not actually allowed to come into this restaurant unless you have a negative COVID-19 test. And so that's one way that we can make things safer. So the whole point is to slow transmission. And part of that is through individuals being aware of this and changing their behavior accordingly, as well as implementing some safeguards, because people may be more willing to take risks, be less careful about infecting other people. So we need the safeguards within society, this idea about public health, to protect the health of all.
So let's talk a little bit about the various tests that are available. So I think, you know, everybody's vocabulary has expanded to include PCR. I think, you know, there's some discussion or at least knowledge around antibodies and then antigens. I'm going to put antibodies to one side because I think, you know, research, I'm not sure that it contributes to the conversation, certainly here. But when you think about the PCR and the antigen test, we don't have a lot of antigen testing currently, but I think we're starting to see more of that. There's discussions around accuracy. You know, that's a non-granular term. Help us understand the underlying important elements of this. You know, do we have to have 100% accurate test, or can we do with something that's less, and how do we cope with that? And how do you respond to people that say, because I hear this all the time, the antigen test is inaccurate, it's no good. Help people understand and sort of tease out the reality of that.
Sure. So I agree with you about, let's put antibody testing aside. So antibody testing is a test of either current infection or past exposure. And let's focus just on PCR testing and the antigen screening tests that are both tests for current infection. When we're thinking about slowing the transmission of COVID-19, we really want to focus on the tests that are tests of current infection, because that's what informs whether we need to quarantine or self-isolate. To prevent the spread. So there are different types of testing, PCR, rapid screening tests. Even within the rapid antigen tests, there are different manufacturers that have different accuracy levels and different methods of doing the testing. And also there's different methods within PCR testing as well. And so this idea about, does the test need to be 100% accurate? The PCR test is not even actually 100% accurate. It's very, very highly accurate. But the main thing we need to think about is not, does this test, for example, with the antigen test, does it match up exactly with the PCR? And more, can we figure out what this test is telling us and how we can accurately interpret that? So I focus not on the test result being accurate, but on the interpretation of the test result being accurate. And I can give one example about the weather report. An accurate weather report might tell you there's a 50% chance of rain tomorrow. That's an accurate weather report. It tells you that there actually is a 50% chance of rain. And we all know how to interpret that. So with an antigen test, it may only be able to tell you, it may only have an accuracy rate of 98% or 90%. That's still high enough if we can think, okay, well, we know it's not 100%. So how do we adapt how we think about this test? And we've seen that the antigen tests are highly accurate for detecting when somebody is contagious. So there may be situations, we know there are situations where people have virus in their body, but they're no longer able to transmit it. And that might be a situation where the PCR test would come back positive, but the rapid antigen test would come back negative. So the idea about these rapid screening tests is they're really very good tests for whether somebody is contagious. The challenge is that they don't catch all of the contagious cases, but they catch the majority of them. So given that information, we can make really smart decisions about how to use these rapid antigen tests. So the idea that if you get a negative rapid antigen test, it does not mean that you're not infectious. And it does not mean that you're not going to become infectious the very next day. So what do? We take some relief in the fact that right now we're not contagious. We're unlikely to be contagious, but we know there's still a risk of transmission. And so we want to adjust our behavior accordingly. So the rapid screening tests are very, very good for reducing the prevalence of COVID-19 in the population. They're not necessarily very good for giving somebody a 100% certainty that they're negative with COVID-19. So they reduce the population prevalence. So what does that mean? That means that they're the kind of things we might want to use with schools, where we're testing everybody in schools. And we know we're not going to catch all of the cases. So we need to have other ways, kind of backup ways. We should be masking. We should be social distancing. We should be cautious about symptoms and employing quarantine when necessary. But adding another layer of doing the rapid screening tests means that we're going to be able to reduce the prevalence within the school population, even if we can't catch every case. And so as long as we understand what these tests can and can't do, there's no reason that we shouldn't be using them. The potential drawbacks to them are very, very, almost certainly unlikely to outweigh the positive benefits of introducing these tests. And I know people are concerned about these potential negative consequences, but I think about them as, you know, there's going to be a lot of benefit and some drawbacks. But if the drawbacks don't outweigh the benefits, we should do it anyway and figure out ways to address these drawbacks. So there's some concerns about false negatives and false positives. So you want to think about how we can actually address those. But I will say that there is the example of Slovakia, which a few weeks ago did kind of a mass testing program. They used these rapid screening tests. It was entirely voluntary. And the isolation following a positive test was also entirely voluntary. And you can see that they were able to slash the population prevalence of COVID-19 really within just a week. And it seemed very, very effective to do that. And the important thing to note is that as far as I know, and I've looked into this, I don't think they did anything at all to address potential false negatives or false positives. And yet they were still able to make a massive dent in their population prevalence. And so I think that's a really good sign that it is possible for these tests to be implemented in a way that is really powerful and effective. And also that if we do that, we need to make sure that we put in the safeguards to make sure that if we do it here in the US, it would be as effective. But that's the idea, is that these can work if they're implemented properly. And so we need to figure out as soon as possible how to implement them properly. And if they seem like they're going to be effective, we need to massively scale them up.
So I think, you know, what strikes me about this is the level of complexity. And, you know, as you rightly point out, it's all about the interpretation. We have information, but we need to interpret it in the context of where it's coming from, the context of the surrounding experiences. And my sense is that we've done a pretty poor job in communicating this in a way that people can understand, because this takes a lot of essentially deeper understanding of all of the details. In the remaining minutes that we've got, can you share a little bit of where you think this will go and how we can get better, not just by expanding the testing, I think that's clear. But how do we get better at communicating it so that there's better compliance, people understand why they're doing it, we don't have the resistance? We've just done a poor job. That seems to be part of the sort of challenge here.
Yes, I mean, we have a pandemic that is basically making it very difficult for people to function in a lot of ways. People are overloaded. People don't have access to childcare. People are managing a whole lot of work. People have lost a lot of their social support. And so we need to be really mindful of the fact that people are not functioning at 100%. And what can we do from a public health and policy standpoint to support people? And so with the rolling out of the rapid screening tests, I disagree with some people who are focused very much on having it be an at-home test. My ideal situation would be to have these rapid screening tests rolled out in what I call a food truck model or the Starbucks model. The idea that you can go and swing by somewhere very easily, get a very quick test, you get the results sent to you, but then you'd also be connected to the public health infrastructure. And part of that is about what we've just talked about in terms of interpretation. So a rapid screening test result is actually interpreted slightly differently depending on whether you have symptoms or not. It's actually interpreted slightly differently depending on what the population prevalence is in your community. And so giving people just the tests without enough information to really understand how to accurately interpret them is not ideal. And so this idea about, well, we want people to have really easy access to testing so they can do it frequently and get their results quickly. Is there a way to do that while also providing the support in terms of communicating the results, so guiding people's behavior? And the other component of it is that if we have it through this food truck or Starbucks model, the idea is that then that test result actually is part of surveillance. And so it actually gives us even more information to evaluate the testing program, to figure out what's going on in terms of the pandemic. Just testing at home with voluntary reporting is a real big challenge for surveillance, because people report for some reasons and not for others. Whereas going to seek a test, we do understand a fair amount about how that selection works. Because, for example, I've done a lot of research, many people have done a lot of research into that. So that process we understand better. We know how to back out what's going on with the epidemic based on kind of somewhat centralized testing or the Starbucks food truck model, we know less about what would happen with the COVID-19 epidemic in terms of surveillance if we rely purely on people voluntarily reporting their at-home tests. So that's one concern I have, but I think this idea about the food truck model is really very powerful. It can have just as big an impact as the home testing, and perhaps an even bigger impact because we also get the surveillance data that feeds into so many other components to improve the public health response.
Fantastic. As usual, and unfortunately, especially given the relevance of the topic, we've run out of time. I think fantastic insights. Obviously, more testing is coming. Perhaps it's going to be a blend of some of those various models, and you know, the importance of where that data is coming from and how it informs our decisions is clearly going to be an imperative. Just remains for me to thank you for joining me on the show. Zoe, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Nick. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, The Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.